The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Story to tell you, though it's hard to hear him speak.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Friday, last radio day of the week. I'm back in the Beltway for a couple of days. You may remember this song. I'm playing a special intro this morning. It's a song John Drozdic done in honor of his friend Augie Nieto. And Augie died yesterday. You may remember, if you're a longtime listener of this show, you'll remember that Augie came to the studio, my gosh, it's over a decade ago in California. And Augie developed ALS 19 years ago. And ALS is, I think, the worst disease, the hardest to deal with, and it brings out the best and the worst in people. And it brought out the very best in Augie and Lynn and their children, the whole family. Augie founded Life Fitness, in 1975, some long time ago, and it was fabulously successful. All the life cycles you use, all the gym equipment. So Augie was Mr. Fitness, and he ran marathons, and he did life cycling, and he made a lot of money, and he did great American, even if he is from Illinois. Moved out to Southern California, and Augie's brand grew and grew and grew. And then he got diagnosed with ALS, and ALS is usually a 3 to 5 year fight, but for some people who figure it out and just cope and get great medical care, they can, as Augie did, live for 20 years fighting the disease. And he didn't just do that, though. Augie went out on the road and he raised money every year with Augie's Quest, and he left a message. Let's bring the music down so I can let people hear this. He said, if there ever comes a day when we can't be together, keep me in your heart. I'll stay there forever, Winnie the Pooh. If you are reading this, then that day has come. As hard as it is to leave my friends and dear family behind, I know my fight is not over. I've battled ALS for almost 18 years. Physically, ALS has taken my body, but my battle to rid the world of this insidious disease will continue. I know I have a lot to be thankful for. I was luckier than most and was able to enjoy those close to me longer than so many friends with ALS. I'm thankful for my family as I count them as the finest achievement of my life. I'm thankful for my friends who stayed by my side and were a constant reminder of how precious life is in spite of its difficulties. Please keep me in your hearts. Please help continue the progress of Augie's Quest to cure ALS. And please help Lynn carry on the mission, the second finest achievement of my life. Because I will be in your heart, I will get to experience the joy we discover when we discover a cure. Thank you for making my life better by virtue of being in it. Forever in your heart, Augie. Our friend John Campbell, who is on the Tuesday edition of the Highly Concentrated Hugh podcast, has been my friend for a long time. He was Augie's friend forever. They were in YPO together. And I think he first introduced me to or told me about it. And then John arranged for Augie to visit me in the studio. And then I went to one of Augie's the fundraisers where John performed. And it was just wonderful. The guy raised $200 million for ALS research. And he did it in an extraordinary way. Grants were made on an ongoing basis, meaning that if the research wasn't producing results, they cut off and move on. Just sort of like product delivery. Because basic research into ALS could go on forever. But Augie wants a cure. Augie's Quest is for a cure. So a great American who took adversity and turned it into being able to help other people. Augie Nieto left us yesterday. So pray for him, pray for his family, and continue to support Augie's Quest. Everyone out there with ALS in your life, in your own life, or in your family's life, or your friend's life, understand it's a winnable disease. That progress is happening every day, and it's going to come. Let me begin with the news of the day, with the most important headline. I'm not sure many people will cover this headline. Well, let me begin by telling you, I'm back in the Beltway. I'm coming back to California tomorrow. It's a very tricky thing to time when the weather is terrible in California and get to D.C. on the day when it was 80 degrees, sunny. Friday, yesterday, we had meetings all day. When the cherry blossoms are out in Northern Virginia, where I live, it's extraordinary. It just I don't think I've ever seen it since 1983 when I first moved here. And you know, I visited in the 70s, but I just never have seen the cherry blossoms come out in February. Now, that's not great for the tourism business, but it's spectacular for people who live here. People are out taking pictures. Now, it's not, I don't know if it's everywhere, but they have this early thaw. It was 80 degrees yesterday, 80 degrees in February in Virginia. It'll be back into the 30s tomorrow. So I'm going back to California after the winter storm is over. But the most important thing, Americans obsessed with winter, is this story. U.S. to expand troop presence in Taiwan for training against the China threat. The U.S. is markedly increasing the number of troops deployed to Taiwan, more than quadrupling the current number to bolster a training program for the island's military amid a rising threat from China. The U.S. plans to deploy between 100 and 200 troops to the island in the coming months, up from 30 there a year ago, according to U.S. officials. The larger force will expand the training program the Pentagon has taken pains not to publicize, as the U.S. works to provide Taipei with the capabilities it needs to defend itself without provoking Beijing. Stop worrying about provoking Beijing. It's not like they don't know. It's not like their, quote, wolf warrior diplomats aren't poking their eye in America every day. They are. And now they're thinking about lethal aid for Ukraine. And that will escalate the war there. But do not worry about what your enemy is going to do. That's appeasement. Trying to beg them not to do things and worrying about what they will, their feelings. It's what led to this catastrophe in Ukraine a year ago is the perceived weakness of President Biden after he skedaddled from Afghanistan with 13 dead American troops in his wake and thousands, tens of thousands of abandoned green card holders, American citizens, SIB eligible people. Weakness breeds conflict. Strength doesn't. So this is a good move. Don't worry about publicizing it. A federal judge has ordered depositions of former President Trump, FBI Director Wray, in a long-running dispute with ex-FBI officials. It's not ex-FBI. It's Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. They disparage the president in private messages about him. They claim they have proved that FBI bias fueled the Russia probe. Trump has said that forever. He said it to me. The former president said it to me recently. And of course, he's angry with Stroke and Page. And I don't know what they intend to do, but they get deposed, too, in the course of this thing. So while you might be focused on the potential deposition, 2 hours limited to a precise set of questions, don't be. Understand that Stroke and Page are going to come under endless discovery. And they're counting on you to not pay attention to it. They're trying to change the narrative. Because their reputations are shattered. They lost their job. And the question is whether or not they're going to be able to persuade anyone that Donald Trump did something wrong. And that is not going to be the case. Other headlines. In the fog of East Palestine's crisis, politicians write their own stories, according to the New York Times. CNN did a town hall. I missed it on Thursday night from East Palestine. And it's 40 miles south of Warren, where I grew up. It's a fine little town, about 5,000 people, high school, the East Palestine Bulldogs. Have about 300 people in it. It's just an amazing place to go and to grow up. But I will tell you this. I used to go down there when the basketball team would go. We would normally play East Palestine in tournaments at the end of the year. So that's what I know about. It's not much because they were 40 miles away, a little bit down the road. But it was a beautiful town. And Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg ignoring it until yesterday is pretty extraordinary. Now, Pete Buttigieg did speak to it yesterday, cut number 10.
In retrospect, should you have come a little sooner?
So, again, in terms of the timing of the visit, I'm trying to strike the right balance, allowing NTSB to play its role, but making sure we're here in that show of support.
Okay, cut number 11.
Both information and misinformation injected into this situation, none of which is to the benefit of the community when it comes to that misinformation.
You can't talk your way out of this, Pete. Everyone knows the gig is up. Everybody knows you just haven't. I don't know what you've been doing. Whatever it is you're doing, it isn't working. And so he blames, of course, Biden playbook 101. He blamed President Trump. Cut number 12.
Judge, yeah. You mentioned a national political figure who's decided to get involved. It sounds like you're talking about Trump. And then you said, I need your help. How can he help?
Well, one thing he could do is express support for reversing the deregulation that happened on his watch. I heard him say he had nothing to do with it, even though it was in his administration. So if he had nothing to do with it, and they did it in his administration against his will.
All right, stop right there. That's just sophistry. That's just absolute sophistry. I'm playing it for you to know that there is nothing Pete won't say. Really. He's a Rhodes Scholar, all that good stuff. Great. I thought he was pretty impressive. That's an outright lie. And the secretary knows that. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'll be right back. It's Friday. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. Good morning, America. That music means Sonny Bunch, the official movie critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show, is in the house. Good morning, Sonny.
Hi, Hugh. How are you?
I'm great. You wouldn't believe it, but the cherry blossoms are actually out already in Washington, D.C.
Oh,
I know, it was 80 degrees here yesterday. I'm leaving again because this is all a false flag operation by the climatologist. I got to ask you very quickly, are you going to see the Jesus Revolution, the Greg Laurie movie?
Probably not. I don't even know what that is. I've not seen ads or...
Kelsey Grammer stars as Chuck Smith, who led the Jesus People Revolution in the 70s in Southern California. And it's got a good budget and a good cast. It's not a Fandango or whatever they call those things, those one day events. It's a release. It's in general release. Fathom event. It's not a Fathom event. It's a real movie. I haven't seen much about it, but I have seen it. What is new? Is there anything out there in the desert that is American cinema in January and February?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that movie. Now that you mentioned it, I can say that I have heard of it, but it is definitely part of the, you know, kind of counter industry, the shadow industry that exists entirely in another realm, right? I mean, there's a whole universe of these movies, you know, the God's Not Dead type things that don't get promoted in the regular ways and still do decent business because they have, you know, they do their advertising through churches and through that sort of stuff.
And the Jesus Revolution has got a big name, Kelsey Grammer. And then it's got the guy who is played Jesus in The Chosen, which has audiences in the tens of millions. And so he does a bit of the, but I've seen their stream of ads because, of course, we're on Salem Broadcasting, Salem Media, which is faith-based in its origins and in much of its broadcasting, the Christian side of the radio group. This is a secular side. It's come across my desk, and I know Greg, and I had Chuck Smith on the show when he was alive. So it's an interesting development that there is a parallel universe. I'm not going to call it the shadow, a parallel universe that is not seen by a lot of Americans.
Yeah, no, it's just it's interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I'll try and check that out. Again, I am not aware of it because it has not had the kind of standard, advertising rollout, but I'll try and see it. Cocaine Bear. You know, Hugh.
Cocaine Bear? Well, that's quite a switch from the Jesus Revolution to the Cocaine Bear. Okay, tell me about Cocaine Bear. I haven't heard of that. I missed it completely.
This is why, you know, Hollywood is full of degenerates. No idea about the Jesus movie, but Cocaine Bear, everyone in America knows about Cocaine Bear. Cocaine Bear. So Cocaine Bear is an interesting movie because it promises you one thing. Can you guess what that thing is, Hugh?
Dissolution.
Well, it promises you a bear on cocaine. I mean,
yeah, that's what I mean. But I'm going
you're
very
high-minded now. That's,
I'm going to the end point of every cocaine addict I've ever heard of. It ends up in dissolution. But go ahead.
This movie is one of these kind of high concepts, almost meme movies. Remember Snakes on a Plane?
Oh, yes.
Snakes on a Plane?
I never saw it, but... But I saw all the trailers and everybody saw Snakes on a Plane and they know what they mean.
Yeah, right. So Snakes on a Plane is kind of the model here. You have a movie that is essentially a meme or a meme waiting to be born in terms of what it is for the broader culture. Snakes on a Plane is kind of an interesting movie, not because it's good, because it wasn't good, but because it's the first movie that was really given rewrites by the internet. It at one point in its life, it had been a pretty straightforward thriller. It had been there were snakes on a plane, but it was a thriller in the air, you know, something like a Turbulence or an executive action, some executive decision, something like that. And when the internet found out about it, you know, there was all this talk about, you know, it's got Samuel L. Jackson, and, you know, it's the sort of movie where you expect to hear him say, I'm tired of these MFing snakes on my MFing plane. And that was, the movie was literally rewritten to give him that line, to put the line that the internet wanted him to say in the movie.
Oh.
Cocaine Bear is very much like this, in the sense that this is a movie where you have a bunch of people standing around shouting lines like, the bear did cocaine, and the bear is doing something like weird and silly, and you're supposed to turn that image into a GIF and put that on Twitter. That's what this movie is.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a meme.
It's trying to look for a viral moment and trying to get people in to see it and laugh, and probably those people are stoned or whatever it is. Do you remember Mr. Wolf from Pulp Fiction?
Sure, yeah.
I was talking about him last night with my son, because you were talking about how there are the wolves in American media that they're sending to clean up messes in the American media. And that guy, that they didn't intend him to be the great character that he became, kind of an icon of deliberate ruthlessness in fixing disasters. Is there a theme that came out of Snakes in the Plane, or a theme that comes out of Cocaine Bear that is like, that will lead to a wolf-like character in the American imagination?
Well, no, because everybody in this movie is incompetent. I mean, this movie is it is very much structured for the bear who is on cocaine to be the hero of the thing. Think about Jaws, right? In Jaws was the title character. But Jaws was, you know, everybody wanted to stop Jaws. Stopping Jaws was the point of that movie. And I do not think stopping the cocaine bear is really the point of this movie. The cocaine bear really is, the in a very real way, the hero. Everybody else is kind of a goofball or an idiot.
And what's the takeaway line from Jaws?
We're going to need a bigger boat.
Bigger boat. That's it. And so
if
you've got a takeaway line or a takeaway character, you've succeeded in penetrating the collective imagination of America. Does Cocaine Bear have such a moment?
I really don't think it does, honestly. I mean, one of my editors asked me this, like, is there like line from it that, you know, is great and will be, you know, passed around? And I don't think there is. I really don't think there is. It's a weird movie because it is only doing one thing, and it does that thing. It is also kind of shockingly, brutally violent.
I don't need that. Pulp Fiction was too, wasn't it?
Yes. But I mean, this is a hard R horror movie in a very weird way. There's lots of gore, and most of the laughs in this picture. It's a weird movie because most of the laughs come from shocking moments of unexpected violence. I would say if that is the thing that made me laugh more frequently than anything else that happened.
Once upon a time in America had a lot of violence in it, but I still went to see it because it wasn't gruesome, right? It wasn't.
Yeah, this has some pretty gruesome violence.
I'm not going to go see it. I don't like gruesome
limbs separated from body. So I want to give people fair warning.
Yeah, that's a good warning. Yeah,
this is not a goofy funny sort of movie, but it is goofy and it is kind of funny. It is also just very, very brutally violent.
So you're talking about Anchorman yesterday at a meeting with some Salem executives, and we're talking about Will Ferrell and Anchorman. That had body parts dismembered too, but it wasn't gruesome. It was hilarious, right? So there are different ways to do violence, and if you're laughing, it's not gruesome. If you're shuddering, it is gruesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the violence in this is both gruesome and I did laugh. Now that may be just because I'm a bad person. I don't know. That's entirely possible.
I don't think you're bad,
but I did find it kind of funny, mostly because it was surprising. Again, this has not really been sold as a hard R horror violence type movie, and it really kind of is that in a way. You know, I mean, it harkens back to some of the 1970s and 1980s creature features, right? Like movies like Alligator, that sort of stuff.
Where you
definitely look, it again, it's a simple movie, and it is.
I liked Alligator.
Not winning any Oscars.
Nobody remembers Alligator, but Alligator is an underappreciated genre of American moviedom.
the big beast. Alligator is it's huge. It's having a big moment now. It's one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies. He has championed it. It's out on 4K and stuff. So people are rediscovering Alligator. I think
is Tarantino going to do another movie? Because it seems like I have to wait for Tarantino movies to go.
He says he wants to make one more. That would be his 10th, and then he wants to retire after that. So
that's a little bit award season, Sonny. I got to get your commentary on the Oscar nomination. There's just nothing to see. We didn't finish Tar. It was so slow. We didn't finish it.
Yeah. You and my wife both.
Okay.
This is one of those movies that I think really benefits from being seen in a theater, not because of the big screen and not because of the sound, though both of those things are good and helpful, and I am pro them, but because when you're in the theater, you are focused entirely on what's happening on the screen. You're trapped. You're in the theater. You're there for the long haul. So, the way Tar is kind of structured, it's a series of very slowly accumulating details. Until I don't know what point in the movie you.
I think we made about an hour in and we faded.
Okay,
said that. Yeah, this
so,
isn't for us.
So it's a series of very slowly accumulating details until her life falls apart with rapidity, like just very, very fastly. And that is how it's kind of how life is, really, right?
Yes.
But I totally also understand why normal viewers watching it at home kind of are like, why am I watching this? Why am I doing this to myself and bail on it?
Let's turn it over to Sherlock or something. Yeah, let's watch it forever. It's hard for movies if they don't grab you in a home situation for the reason you just said. There's no sunk cost, right? You're not glued to your seat by a $20 investment.
Yeah, exactly. No, the reason I am most in favor of theaters is because it commands your attention in a very real way that watching at home does not. It's an entirely different viewing experience. When people talk about the movie theaters, they're like, I want the big screen experience. I want the IMAX screen and I want the big speakers. And I want to be surrounded by sound. And like all of that is important to a certain extent, but I do think that the actual real benefit of theater is just having your attention monopolized.
Focused. Sonny Bunch, you can go and watch his podcast or listen to Across the Movie Aisle or The Bulwark Goes to the Movies. Sonny has two a week. He'll be back next week. Thank you, Sonny Bunch. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned to the Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show from the Beltway is underway. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. You get your gold at hughgold.com or by texting my name, Hugh, to 989898. You know why we're going to have a debt limit crisis? Because the U.S. has blown through $31.4 trillion. The national debt was under $6 trillion before 9/11. And in the 20 years since, we have added $25 trillion to it. That's not sustainable. And that means the money, the value of the money is going down. But you know what has kept pace with inflation since the early part of the last century? Gold. Gold holds its value. There's no better way to make sure you're safe against hyperinflation, safe against all the upset that comes with a debt limit crisis. All you need to do is get some gold. Start an IRA, a 401k today. They physically store your physical precious metals. A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. Thousands of happy customers. Birch Gold is who I trust. Text Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 989898 today. Birch Gold at hughgold.com. Welcome back, America. Who'll Stop the Rain is my bump music. And that's in honor of the West Coast. And soon, all across the United States, I'm standing by waiting for Admiral Stav to join us on this. It's the first anniversary of the second Putin war against Ukraine. And Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, joins us, former Allied Supreme Commander in NATO, former head of Southern Command. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. How's it going?
It's great. Now, Admiral, what I would like to know from you, if you're going to stand up, if you're back in your old job leading in the Fletcher School, and you were going to address a group of students about the unexpected course and future likely path of the second invasion of Putin on the first anniversary of it, what would you say?
I'd say that Putin has a miscalculated terribly here, and he has led his nation down the hole. Which is going to have a great deal of
Admiral, we're going to stop and call you back. For whatever reason, we can't hear you. So we're screwed up this morning. We've been trying to make this work for a couple of days. Why don't we do it by phone? I'll have I don't want people to miss this. I've been waiting to talk to the Admiral about the anniversary, and I don't want to have it distorted. And when it is, because of, you know, they're interesting. Starlink. Elon Musk needs to put a Starlink over the Admiral's house. That's all I can say. That will help us all out in the world if Elon will post a Starlink over there and we're able to connect with him. I would encourage all of you who have a subscription to The Telegraph, which is the Great Britain newspaper that I read. They have in there the five weapon systems that changed the course of the war. And I want to ask the Admiral which one is the most important, but I also want to ask him, what do we have to do next? There he is. So, Admiral, let's go back to the question I posed you. What do we do?
The three things we should be doing at this point are, number one, provide the absolute maximalist amount of military capability.
Admiral, it ain't working. Huh, no. I don't know what's up. This is like a breakdown of the Starlink connection.
No. Can you hear me now?
We're going to drop your video. No, not yet. We're gonna try again, and the echo's got to go away. And I think we are going to have to just call him on the phone. Are you there on the phone, Admiral?
Yes, I'm right here on the phone. It should be pretty clear for you.
That's good. Go ahead.
Okay, so here we are. We're 1 year into this thing. And I think the key question is, what do we do now? Number one, we continue to provide significant military capability. And that, in my view, would include fighter aircraft. Notably MiG-29, F-16, both can be done. There are some naysayers that say, oh, it'll take a long time to train to fly the F-16. I don't know. These are trained combat pilots. We're not trying to turn Hugh Hewitt into a fighter ace. We're trying to get some.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's the armaments to include ATACMS, the combat aircraft, the longer range cruise missiles to go after the Black Sea fleet, all of that. Number two, we continue to push on the sanctions. And over time, that is going to have significantly more impact on Russia. And let's face it, the global energy economy is kind of rewiring itself in front of us. But long term, the economics are deeply against Russia. Point being that if you look at the global economy, on one side, U.S., Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada, South Korea, Singapore, add all that up, that's about 65% of global gross domestic product. On the other side is Russia, which has maybe 2%, less than that now. And even if China completely throws in, which I don't think they will, but if they do, it's still only another 15% on that side of the equation. So over time, big, big storm clouds economically. And third and finally, Hugh, we've got to keep the diplomatic pressure on. And here where I'm worried is China. I'm concerned China may make a mistake here and begin supplying weapons. Real military capability to Russia. Again, I think President Xi is too smart to do that, but that is the path of greatest worry. So there's three things we should be thinking about today on this anniversary.
Admiral, I reminded my friend Kurt Schlichter the other day that China did not hesitate to throw hundreds of thousands of troops into Korea when they thought their strategic interests were threatened by MacArthur's advance of the Yalu River. And so if their strategic interests are threatened, they will act in their own best interest. But I don't think they are. Are they by Putin's defeat? Would they actually have their strategic interests threatened?
No, I don't think so. And frankly, I could spin that the other way in two dimensions. One is it's been 70 years since the Korean War. That's a long time ago. Point being, Xi can't have a high degree of confidence one way or the other in the Chinese military, point one. Point two, and more to the question of the strategic interest of China, I can make the case that a badly wounded, limping Russia with a absolutely cracked military coming out of this conflict presents a real opportunity for China. Think about it this way, Hugh. If you're China, you're looking north at Siberia. It's this vast landmass. This is Russia to the east of the Ural Mountains. And nobody lives there. There's, I don't know, 25 million people in an area the size of the continental United States. But what's it full of? Oil, gas, timber, arable land, fresh water, diamonds, gold, rare earths. It looks mighty tasty if you're Chinese. And a weakened Russia presents some interesting strategic opportunities to China.
Now, Admiral, when the Chinese talk about the century of humiliation, it includes Russia taking their northern province, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, there's not a natural gravitational pull, frankly, between China and Russia. You provide one pretty good instance of it. Let's not forget, during the Cold War, these two communist powers were never significantly aligned, had many disagreements, including philosophies of communism, but all the way to borders and geopolitics, as you correctly point out. And oh, by the way, go back to 55 days at Peking, as it was called then, now Beijing, and it's all part of the humiliation of China, which included Russia.
Now, let me talk to you before our audience goes off. Moldova is under an extraordinary... Have you been to Moldova? I'm going to be astonished if you've been to Moldova.
Hugh, of course I've been to Moldova. I've been, I think, twice, maybe three times. Don't forget, it's part of the U.S. European Command's orbit. It's area of responsibility, as it's called. So I've been at least twice. It's one of the poorest countries, perhaps the poorest country in Europe. And the problem, its major problem, is about a third of its territory is already occupied by Russia, which has set up this kind of puppet regime there called Transnistria. And over the last few weeks, we've seen, I think, pretty credible reports that Russia is seeking to undermine the government in Chisinau, which is the capital. So here's the point. Russia is not only making moves on Ukraine, they're making moves on this tiny, impoverished country, Moldova, and they are also quite clearly intent on simply absorbing Belarus, which is a pretty big nation just to the north of Ukraine. The whole thing is part of Putin's, quote, master plan, unquote, to reconstitute as much as he can of the old Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Moldova, Ukraine, and Belarus, of course, were all part of that.
Now, I know Moldova's elected prime minister does not want that. And I know that Russian propaganda is saying they're threatening the ammunition depot that the Russians control in that Transnistria, whatever it is called. But does Belarus want to be absorbed? They've got their own little dictator going there. Does he want to give everything over to Putin?
Yeah, this is Lukashenko, who often jokes about who's the bigger, badder dictator. It's also kind of amusing to see him and Putin stand next to each other, because Putin's a tiny guy like I am, and his fellow dictator in Belarus just towers over him. He looks like Shaquille O'Neal standing next to Danny DeVito. But the point is, I think generally the Belarusians, the population, has no desire to be absorbed by Russia. The majority of that population pretty clearly wants to lean to the West. They've tried to overthrow their dictator several times. He has cracked down with help from Moscow. This is another one of the color revolutions, but one that didn't really take off. Came very close about 2 years ago, just before pandemic times. The bottom line is, Belarus would like to remain an independent country, but I think Putin has other ideas for them.
I want to close, Admiral, because you were the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. The only good thing that's come out of a war that's claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and destroyed Ukraine is it brought NATO together. It is going to bring Finland and Sweden into NATO. Poland, I read 2 days ago, is going to put 4% of their GDP into becoming the largest standing army in Western Europe. What do you think about the unintended consequences of this war on NATO, which you used to lead?
Yeah, that distant boom you hear is Vladimir Putin's head exploding with frustration. These are all immensely unintended consequences from the perspective of Moscow, and you've ticked them off very well. Of all of them, I think the most significant potentially is Poland, which has a great deal of antipathy for Russia, a long bad history with the Cossacks and the Russians, and for them to stand up and move forward strongly, vital. Germany is moving along as well, has created a special fund with billions in it. Sweden and Finland, quite correct, they're going to present Putin with a new 800-mile frontier, plus put pressure on his plans for the Arctic. So the silver lining here in this horrific war is, in fact, NATO unity.
Admiral James Stavridis, thank you for joining me this morning. Follow him at StavridisJ on Twitter. He's also often on the media. Always tune in. Put down whatever you're doing. Listen to the Admiral when he comes on to talk about whatever it is he's talking about, because he knows of which he speaks. He's been to Moldova. One of these days, I'm going to find a place on the planet he hadn't been that's going to be in the headlines. I can't go, like, testing him just to see if he's been to a little city in Paraguay. But he probably has been since he had Southern Command. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Look, you did the tough thing during COVID. You paid your people and pulled your business through the pandemic, or really the lockdown. And now doing the tough thing could qualify you for up to $26,000 per employee at COVIDtaxrelief.org. Government funds are available to reward companies with two or more employees who stayed open during COVID. This is not a loan, and you don't have to pay it back. The program is complicated, but nobody knows more about it than the CPAs and tax experts at COVIDtaxrelief.org. You pay nothing up front. They do all the work and share a percentage of the cash they get you. Businesses of all types, including nonprofits and churches, can qualify, including those who took PPP loans, even if you had increases in sales. You did the tough thing for your employees during COVID. Let COVIDtaxrelief.org help you get up to $26,000 per employee. Visit COVIDtaxrelief.org. That's COVIDtaxrelief.org.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt on Friday. Sarah Westwood of the Washington Examiner joins us when we are lucky. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You know, it is amazing. I'm in D.C. for a couple of days. I don't normally come back until April. And the cherry blossoms are out. This is really wild. What do you think?
It's wild. It's supposed to be winter. I was kind of hoping to get snow at least once, but, you know, it's almost sundress season.
Well, it's nevertheless, be careful, because I get out of here because a snow blizzard could come through. Sarah, on the anniversary of the first anniversary of the second invasion by Putin of Ukraine, what is support like for more weaponry in Congress on both sides of the aisle?
I think it's still pretty high, despite the fact that you are sort of sensing some fatigue within the Republican Party. There are, though, some skeptics. You know, J.D. Vance in the Senate is a big one. Some of the conservative Republicans in the House who did not want Kevin McCarthy to be speaker initially have also sort of expressed some concerns about, you know, the Biden administration not laying out any strategic endpoints for this conflict and there being so little oversight of the money so far and so little interest from the Biden administration and keeping track of what that money is buying. So, you know, it's a small but growing group, I think, of Republicans who are skeptical of continuing aid at the levels we've been doing.
Now, within the GOP caucus, you have the two Mikes and a Jim, Mike Gallagher, Michael Waltz, and Jim Banks. And they are the public-facing hawks. This is Mike Rogers of the Republican. Do they have an open debate inside the caucus? Do they know, you know they're defending, supporting Ukraine and pushing back against the Chinese and building the Navy? Is the debate open or is it guerrilla tactics between the two camps? Because I think the non-interventionists, maybe even quasi-isolationists, are a small number of Republicans.
It is a small number, but I think you have a lot of different opinions along the spectrum of, you know, let's cut off aid altogether, not one more penny.
Oh, what is going on with the internets today? Sarah just dropped. And I mean, it went black. If you're watching on the Salem News Channel, that's the first time we've ever gone to black on her side of the screen. So I'm watching my return, obviously, from my studio. And she just went south. So the Russians must not like what she was about to say. I'm sure Well, maybe we'll reconnect. I don't know. We don't have a lot of time. Sarah is always on top of stuff, and I really wanted to hear that. Jim Banks, by the way, is going to be the next senator from Indiana. And Mike Braun's going to be the next governor of Indiana. And that's over. Indiana's a red state. There is no primary challenge to either of them. The attorney general of Indiana waved off both. And so Jim Banks cleared the field. Mitch Daniels said he's not going to run, which is good all around. Saves Mitch's from a nasty primary battle that Jim Banks would have won anyway. And so Jim Banks is going to walk right in, sit right down, and become a great senator from the Hoosier state in the mold of Dick Lugar. He will be strong on national security. She's back. So I was talking about Jim Banks while I filled, Sarah. So how goes the conversation inside of the GOP caucus?
Thanks. Sorry, I talked to myself for a while. So I do think you have Republicans in the middle of that spectrum. You have a lot of them who, the majority of them, want to keep aid going really at current levels. You have a small number like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz who want to cut off aid altogether, not one more penny to Ukraine. But then you have a lot of Republicans in the middle who question the amounts that we've been sending, the speed at which the money has been dispersed to Ukraine, and whether some of this money shouldn't be attached to strings or at least requirements for more oversight. And I do think that that group in the middle is growing. So maybe there will be some marginal changes to the levels of aid if Republicans had their way. But, you know, I think that the people who want to cut off the aid altogether, their numbers are small.
What matters most is what does Speaker McCarthy think. Now, I hear from Republicans and conservatives and even independents and many Democrats across the spectrum on Ukraine. I had a couple of naysayers earlier this morning and a week of naysayers because they want to be heard and I want them to be heard. But what does Speaker Kevin McCarthy think about aid to Ukraine?
So interestingly, he sort of laid his cards on the table before the speaker race, before even the midterm elections, and said, you know, there will be no more free blank checks for Ukraine. So he sort of sympathized with this group in the middle who do want to see more oversight and potentially more restrictions. You know, we have been putting aid to Ukraine at a sort of historic clip. I mean, this past year, Ukraine has received more aid than Afghanistan did annually at the peak of the war. So this is a sort of an unprecedented speed at which Ukraine has been given money. To potentially slow that down or to look at, can we prioritize the areas where we're helping Ukraine? Do we need to prop up their agriculture sector, for example, their housing sector? Just reexamining where all that money is going and whether every penny of it is necessary. That's sort of what Kevin McCarthy has laid out. And I do think you're seeing that start to become a more popular opinion within the conference.
That's the Governor DeSantis approach, right? No more blank check. The blank check, the opponents of blank check aid are in the middle between hawks like me and the withdrawal folks, right?
That's right. And, you know, I think Ron DeSantis's answer on this was pretty interesting because he sort of did a pivot to China, which isn't necessarily isolationist or calling to trim the defense budget. He's just sort of saying that the Biden administration's foreign policy priorities are misplaced. And I think a lot of Republicans would maybe agree with that.
I do. I think so, too. Sarah, in fact, I linked Mark Thiessen's column in The Washington Post to the note of your appearance on Twitter, which strikes that note exactly. Good to see you, Sarah. Enjoy the weather in D.C. I'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.